from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Governor Baker defends his choice to head the MBTA after a Radio Boston investigation of the new GM's record. Also today, the Celtics trade Isaiah Thomas to Cleveland and a conversation with the first African-American woman on Massachusetts' highest court, Justice Geraldine Hines, about her retirement.
I think I've learned some things along the way about how to push back on a legal system that isn't quite ready to bend toward the arc of justice.
Plus, the master of medical thrillers, Robin Cook.
When the swine flu and the avian flu were both in the same location together in China, I started getting really worried, which is the reason that I wrote Contagion.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Radio Boston's been looking into the record of the newly named head of the MBTA, Luis Ramirez. He's been praised as a turnaround specialist, but a Radio Boston analysis of federal securities filings shows that the Texas company that Ramirez claims to have turned around is dealing with wide-ranging financial problems as a result of issues under Ramirez's tenure. Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney has been working on this story along with Meghna Chakrabarty. Kathleen, hi.
Hi, Deb.
So last week we talked about some of the accounting errors that led the company to correct 4 years of financial statements. Why don't we start by explaining that?
Right. So as you said, state officials praised Ramirez for his experience turning around companies when they named him GM last week, which is why we've been looking at one of the companies that he led for 3 years. It's an energy equipment and maintenance company based in Texas called Global Power Equipment Group. Now, 2 months after Ramirez left the company in 2015, Global Power announced it would need to restate the financial filings for the previous year. As the company investigated, they uncovered accounting errors that affected their financial statements from 2011 through 2014, almost every line item during those years. Now, the errors do predate Ramirez's time at the company, but they also continued throughout his tenure. And the ramifications for the company have been very serious and far-reaching. Here's what Terrence Cryan, who took over as CEO after Ramirez left, told investors back in March.
We were faced with both a financial restatement and the need for an operating turnaround, which has certainly tested all of us over the past 18 months.
Now, note that Cryan said the company needed an operating turnaround after Ramirez, the so-called turnaround guy, left. So here's what happened as a direct result of the accounting problems. Wells Fargo froze Global Power's credit line. This really crippled the business, and the company is scrambling to cut costs and keep running. The company has laid off more than 1,000 employees and closed or consolidated several factories as a result. And the company's stock price has fallen dramatically. It's now down 75% from its value near the end of Ramirez's tenure.
And so how did this all happen, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated, and right now it's not entirely clear. Meghna and my story goes really in-depth, sifting through the company's filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, so listeners should definitely check it out. But the broad strokes, the shareholder lawsuit claims that under Ramirez, quote, all six members of the company's accounting department left Global Power. Huh. The suit also claims Ramirez eliminated the accounting department's training budget entirely. So we haven't been able to confirm those specific allegations, but the company's own internal review found that they did not have effective supervision over its finance and accounting, and they did not have enough qualified personnel to review the technical accounting. The Securities Exchange Commission is investigating the accounting problems, and a group of shareholders, as we mentioned, are suing over this. They claim Ramirez and the former chief financial officer knew about the accounting problems and did nothing. Now, attorneys for Ramirez and Global Power did not return requests for comment, but they have filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit. And Global Power says the company is cooperating with federal regulators.
Mm-hmm. But you know, you mentioned a lot of this happened after Ramirez left the firm. And, you know, what about his direct responsibility here?
Right. And that's the main question here. The experts I talked to said it's not clear whether these were intentional manipulations of the books or they were more innocent mistakes by poorly trained or unqualified bookkeepers. The company says, though, in that report that they issued in March, that they didn't find any intentional misconduct or fraud in its investigations. This is part of what the SEC would be trying to determine in this case. Who at the company knew what and when. But as Ramirez points to Global Power as part of his turnaround experience, it doesn't seem from the picture that we're getting now that the company was turned in the right direction. I spoke with Andrew Vollmer, who's a securities expert at the University of Virginia Law School. He said it's fair to look at what happened afterward, but he did issue a bit of caution.
Things can change that that person did not know about or put into place, and it would be unfair to attribute some development at the company to the former CEO or the former senior executive.
Right. So he's kind of like, you know, you've got to sift through it really carefully. At the same time, I spoke with Mark Bradshaw, who chairs the accounting department at Boston College, told me that there's a lot of red flags. And here's what he had to say about looking at the company now after Ramirez has left.
What's happening now is a direct outcome of what happened then. The things we're having to do are a function of the wheels having spun out of control during his watch.
Now, to be fair, this is only one part of his resume, and we'll be digging into his time at General Electric to get a full picture.
And what does Governor Baker say? I mean, Ramirez also doesn't have any experience in this area either.
Right. I mean, Baker had said from the get-go that he wanted a turnaround CEO. So it's not surprising that he didn't have any public transit or public sector experience. We've put out multiple requests for Baker and Transportation Secretary Pollack and Ramirez. None of them have agreed to speak with us. But yesterday, WBUR Steve Brown did catch Baker at a press conference, and Baker said he stands by Ramirez.
I'm quite confident in Lewis's ability to both do the job and to succeed mightily in doing it. He went through a rigorous search process as part of this initiative, and he brings exactly what the MBTA needs.
And Secretary Pollack issued a statement to us saying, Lewis is the right person at the right time to move the MBTA further down the path to being one of the best transit systems in the country. Now, he'll take over the MBTA September 12th, and time will tell.
All right. Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney, thanks so much.
Thanks, Deb.
For details on Ramirez's tenure at Global Power and what happened to the company since his departure, go to our website, radioboston.org. Boston will say goodbye to Isaiah Thomas. The all-star point guard for the Celtics has been traded to the Cleveland Cavaliers as part of a deal where Boston will gain the Cavaliers point guard, Kyrie Irving. Celtics president of basketball operations Danny Ainge acknowledges that it will be tough to lose Thomas.
It is a high price tag. It is a great value that we're giving up, but you know, acquiring a 25-year-old perennial all-star, a player that, you know, fits a timeline for us and is a fantastic offensive player, is one of the best offensive players in the league. You have to pay a heavy price.
Joining us in studio to talk about this is Bill Littlefield, the host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Deb.
Also with us from the Boston Globe is Joe Sullivan, sports editor for the Boston Globe. He's with us from the studios there. Hi there, Joe.
Hi.
So, and we want to say, listeners, we want to hear from you as well. How do you feel about Isaiah Thomas leaving the Celtics? Is it a good move for the team? And what do you think Thomas's legacy is here in Boston? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Bill, what do you think this trade of Isaiah Thomas and the acquisition of Kyrie Irving means for the Celtics?
I think the most interesting thing in that little clip from Danny Ainge that I just listened to again is the word timeline. This sounds like, you know, and this combined with the fact that there are very few Celtics from last year returning to the team, given the sort of purge that Ainge has pulled off, This is sounds like a building project, and I'm not sure how happy Kyrie Irving is going to be with that, except that he very much wants to be the man in anybody's building project. That's perhaps the main reason why he didn't want to be with the Cleveland Cavaliers any longer.
Is that what we know about him?
Well, that's what he seems to have been. That seems to have been his motivation. It's hard to imagine what else would have motivated him on a team that was that close to winning a championship and had, in fact, won a recent championship, barely lost one this time around. I think that's a fair assumption. As far as the people in Boston, the fans in Boston are concerned, I think there are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, wow, you know, we really had come to enjoy the way Isaiah Thomas played, especially this past year. But mostly what fans do is look and say, let's see if this makes us better. That's what they're most interested in.
You think so? Well, Joe, I want to go to you. Explain a little bit of the trade for us, what Boston gets in return aside from Kyrie Irving.
Oh, so Kyrie Irving is what they get. That's the only thing they get. And they're giving up Isaiah, Jay Crowder, Ante Zizek, who is a Turkish player who's never played for the Celtics and strictly potential. And then they give up a draft choice, a number one draft choice that originally was property of the Brooklyn Nets that the Celtics received in the trade for Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett. So it really is four assets for just one asset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what they gave up.
In the quote, that the price was expensive, but in his mind's worth it.
And he says, he really wanted to have a fantastic offensive player. Well, what's the strategy there?
Well, statistically, they're very close last season. Their individual statistics are across the board very similar.
You mean Irving and
Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they get here is that Irving is already under contract for the next 2 years. Isaiah Thomas's contract runs out after this coming season. And they get a younger player. Isaiah is actually older, 4 years older than Kyrie. So if you're looking toward the future, it's a good deal in that sense. And I think even though they are, even statistically, I think people see the ceiling being much higher for Kyrie Irving, that he could become, I mean, he's already been a four-time All-Star, and he could probably, it wouldn't be surprising if he was a perennial All-Star. Isaiah made the All-Star team the last two seasons, but I think people fear that he could decline quickly because of his age, even though that's a relatively young age for most humans, but in basketball, in athletics.
Was it 29? 20?
Yeah.
Oh, he's ancient.
It can turn quickly. And because of his size, he's so much smaller that he does take a lot of punishment, and he was injured this year. He had a hip injury that made him stop playing during the playoffs. Kyrie Irving's a lot bigger and sturdier. So I think, in general, they're getting a better player than Isaiah Thomas, but I don't want to keep rambling on here. But there's the emotional attachment.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, right?
I think that this is going to make Celtics fans sad in a lot of ways, unless this team with Kyrie Irving as the leading scorer becomes a winning team and a championship team. Because I think everyone really admired the overachiever status that Isaiah Thomas brought to the Celtics, and he turned them from being a losing team. He's one of the main reasons they started winning again and made all the way to the Eastern Finals this year. So I think Celtics fans would miss him. I think it's going to be an emotional loss because I think he was beloved.
Mm.
And right. Kyrie Irving, for maybe the biggest reason that Bill pointed out, is that he's somehow seeking to be the leading scorer on a team, and he'll never be that when he's playing with LeBron James. Strikes me as being there's a selfish streak there that could be troubling.
So they've got very different personalities.
Selfish streaks are fairly common among professional athletes because Isaiah Thomas had already said when my contract is up, I expect them to back the Brinks truck up to the arena because I expect to be paid commensurate with my achievements and my value. And so that may have gone into the mix as well, because that it can be code for whatever team comes up with the best offer, that's where I'm going. There's no sense of sort of loyalty to the Celtics per se.
Right.
And whether the Celtics had the, you know, this could be from the other side that Ainge is telling us he wasn't going to make
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He wasn't the guy that I was going to empty the vault for.
I just want to remind our listeners that we'd like you to weigh in on this as well. Was this a good move on the part of the Celtics? Was Isaiah Thomas a beloved player that maybe should have stayed around a little bit longer? Let us know what you think. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. I'd like to first just point out a couple of things that happened to remind people of Isaiah Thomas and his legacy with the Celtics. And I think a lot of folks might remember the strength that he showed after his sister died. She was in a car accident just before the playoffs. Bill, do you remember that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's impossible to forget. I think it's the kind of story that that makes people feel as if they know a player much better than they would if they'd simply watched him perform on the court. And, of course, there was a great deal written about it. And he handled the situation with remarkable grace and strength, I thought. So the fact that that is part of the package, I think Joe is right. There will be an emotional component to losing the player.
Right.
And it, along with that, and what Bill said is absolutely right, is that he also had the dental problem.
Like, that's right. He got his tooth knocked out during the playoffs.
And he had many teeth damaged by and he played through all that. And that's the type of thing that that makes him beloved, that he still was able to play very well until finally his hip just gave, he gave out, and he wasn't able to keep going.
Well, that was going to be my question for you, Joe. Obviously, a trade of this magnitude, Cleveland has a pretty good idea of Isaiah Thomas's health, but all of this is contingent on all the players involved passing a physical exam. What are the chances that they get Isaiah out there and have an MRI or a couple x-rays or another doctor look at him and say, hey, wait a minute, this guy really is damaged goods. He's going to need an operation. He's going to miss a big chunk of his career. What are the chances something like that happens?
It could happen. You're right. I you know, I would hope that the Celtics would make this deal knowing that he's going to fail a physical. If he does, then it'll be the league will void the trade, and everyone will go back from where they came. It's happened in the past in just about any sport where trades are nullified because the player going from one team to another fails the physical. So it's certainly possible.
You know, folks have written about kind of a lack of sentimentality, right, on the part of Danny Ainge. But I presume it's a balance here, right? I mean, you've got to have a good team. You want to have a winning team. As Bill said, the fans care about, is this going to make us better, right? Is that the primary thing here? Or, you know, what do you think he's balancing here as he makes these kinds of decisions? Joe, I want to ask you this first.
Well, I think it is. Oh, I'm sorry. You, Bill, first? I'm sorry.
No, Joe, you first.
I think that is his goal, is to make the team better with the ultimate goal of winning another championship, and that he would put all sentiment aside. That doesn't mean it's not difficult to do. I think we heard it in his voice where he said it was difficult, but it doesn't mean he's not going to do it. I think Danny's all about making the team as good as it can be, and sentiment be damned.
But if they were close in terms of their abilities, I mean, hip injury aside here, because obviously we don't know what's going on with that, but if they were close in terms of their abilities, like, wouldn't sentimentality sort of tilt it in Isaiah Thomas's favor?
Then I think you have to go back to the point that Joe made a few minutes ago, which is, you know, it's certainly higher, faster, stronger, but the fourth thing is younger. And if they were equal, but one of them was 4 years younger, all right, you take the guy who's got the longer future to provide you with.
Okay. I want to go to our callers. Jack is calling from Pembroke. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how you doing?
Good, thanks. I just
was this a good move?
I'm not sure. And my heart says no. But statistically, it feels like a good move. The only thing I'm worried about is it's very little evidence from which to speculate, but when the Celtics played at the Oracle last year against the Warriors, I remember Isaiah Thomas really having a career night. So my fear is that when Ainge was trying to get us closer to the standard that is the Cleveland Cavaliers, we may have helped LeBron win against the Warriors this year, which I think is a very safe projection for the championship matchup again.
Wow. Well, but overall, I mean, do you think, Jack, that this will, you know, eventually help the Celtics?
Absolutely. I think a lot of my doubt comes from what you all have been talking about, the emotional attachment we've developed to some of these players over the year.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about Isaiah Thomas?
I just remember his charisma, his really fantastic year last year, and that's about it.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much for the call.
You know, the thing about Isaiah is some of the smaller things he did that were sort of fantastic to me, and we wrote about him in the Globe where he was coming out of a parent like a school meeting where his kids went to school, and he saw a young boy shooting baskets in Cambridge, and he went over and he for a few minutes he shot with him and gave him some advice. He also had a dinner. He took the people in the apartment building. They had been a fire, and they had been burned out of their apartments. And he took everyone in the apartment building out to dinner. Those are the types of things that really made him beloved. And I think we got to hope Kyrie Irving brings a similar type of thought process to Boston.
What about the idea of trading with your top rival?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to bring that up, because now we have to watch when the Celtics play the Cavaliers. We have to see whether Kyrie Irving torches the Cavaliers or whether Isaiah Thomas comes back and scores 55 points against the Celtics. And whichever way that happens, you can count on a lot of people saying, "See, I told you that was a terrible trade," in one city or the other.
but is it unusual?
It is unusual.
It is, right?
And in all sports, it's unusual to see a team send players to a team that they're going to have to beat to get to a championship. Absolutely. You don't see the Red Sox and the Yankees making a lot of trades.
Exactly.
There is that marvelous, almost some people say, trade, which involved Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, but everybody had a cup of coffee and realized in the morning it wasn't such a good idea after all, and it didn't happen. That's why.
One of the things at work here is that Irving asked for the trade, and in some ways the Cavaliers, I guess they could have not done it, but I think they were their hand was forced in some
absolutely
ways. He said he wanted out, so a lot of times you have to settle for less than you want in those situations.
No, there was some discussion about trading him to Phoenix, I think, and then that trade, they couldn't get what they thought was value for him, and I think they felt like well, the caller made a very good point. At least in the short run, maybe the change in personnel and the change in attitude with Kyrie not worrying about how many points LeBron James is scoring and Isaiah Thomas taking his place there, maybe that puts him over the top for 1 year. And who knows? They're likely to lose LeBron James after a year anyway at this point.
And Irving has some connections to Boston, right, Joe?
He does. His father played at BU. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, he's one of the best players in BU history. He's in their Hall of Fame. His number's retired. So Dredrick, I'm sorry, I'm pronouncing it wrong. But, he was a great player at BU.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as we know, at least before we went to airtime here, there was no comment from Isaiah Thomas. Is that right? Is that what both of you understand?
There was nothing that I had seen.
I haven't heard from him yet.
And if he is going to comment, what do you expect we're going to hear?
Well, I think he'd probably handle it with a certain amount of grace. I'd probably say I had great years with the Celtics, enjoyed myself thoroughly. The fans were great. It's a standard thing that people say. I think it's probably more interesting to wonder what Kyrie Irving will say, given what people in Cleveland have been saying on social media since they found out he was leaving. But we'll see. We'll see.
Joe, your thoughts on that in our last few seconds?
Yeah, I agree with Bill. I would be surprised if Isaiah didn't handle it gracefully. And, you know, he even said himself when he talked about his own contract that this is a business. And I think he's a mature person who understands that.
And so, Boston sports fans, we have to get that message across as well. There may be some emotions involved here, but this is a business.
Well, it's not a business for them because it's not their money. So they regard it as a passion, and rightfully so. And they'll probably be very sad until the Celtics go 17-0 to start the season, and then they'll say, well, it was a pretty good move.
All right, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which you can hear right here on 90.9 WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Deb.
Also with us was Joe Sullivan, sports editor at the Boston Globe. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Retired Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Justice Geraldine Hines says now that she's no longer a judge, she plans to return to her activist roots. Hines was the first African-American woman on the state's highest court, appointed by former Governor Deval Patrick in 2014. She says she's seen a lot of changes since she was just one of four black students in the University of Wisconsin Law School class of 1971. But Hines also says she's watching, especially now, events that show that some things haven't changed all that much in more than four decades. When we sat down with her earlier this week, we started by asking why she decided to begin her retirement by attending the counter-protest to the so-called free speech rally in Boston on Saturday.
I retired on Friday. And I thought, what a fitting way to re-engage into the work of anti-racism. I live a stone's throw from the Reggie Lewis Center. I walked up there and I saw all the people with the wonderful signs, and the atmosphere was electric. I couldn't help myself. I felt like this is where I'm supposed to be. And I was just delighted to see people that I hadn't seen in years, because when you're a judge, you don't have a chance to associate at events and with certain kinds of people. So I was just delighted. And I think I've read some of the criticism of the counter-protest, that the problem is that it's stifle speech. But I'm not sure that I agree with that.
A lot of folks said that not letting the media in the bandstand.
Well, I don't know.
And not letting people in.
Yeah.
And certainly there was a concern about public safety, because it was very tense.
Right.
Emotions were very high,
right,
on both sides.
Right.
And both sides were fearful.
Right.
So was it okay for authorities to cordon off the rally organizers and not let other folks listen or in because of that concern about public safety? And as a judge, and someone legally trained, I think the legal experts are saying, does that set a dangerous precedent,
right,
in terms of free
well,
speech?
Well, it is. I mean, I agree. I was an ACLU person before I went on the bench, and I believe in the First Amendment. And I do think that their message, they have a right to say that, and at the same time, I think that people who disagree have the right to have their say. And I just don't know that it was possible in the circumstances to get the two groups together so that they could listen to each other. I have a feeling that if Charlottesville hadn't happened, that there would have been more of that's not an excuse, but I have a feeling that there would have been more of an opportunity for people to talk back to each other.
How do you describe your judicial philosophy?
Judicial philosophy.
Is there such a thing?
Well, I always associate judicial philosophy with people who are being asked to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, because in a state appellate court, there's not that much of an opportunity to have a philosophy that you're free to weave into the decisions that the court makes.
Well, some people might say, the SJC has made some decisions that certainly show a particular philosophy. Look at what we did in juvenile justice. Look what the court did there, right? And
I don't think of that as philosophy. I think of that as being committed to an evolution of fairness and justice in the law.
But what about the ruling then that said that judges can consider whether a black person who walks away from a police officer is can flee because they may have a presumed fear of police officers based on what's been happening with police officers okay. around the country? And well, you can clarify that if I'm saying it wrong.
First of all, that's really not what the decision said. And it wasn't a result of a particular philosophy. What the decision said was that in thinking about whether or not a person is engaged in criminal conduct, just because a black person in Boston flees from a police officer doesn't mean that that's not necessarily conduct that suggests consciousness of guilt, because there's all of this overlay, there's all of this history of people being stopped and profiled, and it might just as easily be a way to escape an indignity as it is a way to disguise some kind of criminal intent.
But some folks might say that's a judicial philosophy, right?
Well, you know, I'm just not going to bite on that one. you're showing some good legal skills here. I just don't see myself as having a philosophy. If there's just my one guiding light as a jurist has always been what is just and does the law allow that to happen?
A lot of times this case gets mentioned when your name is mentioned, and that's Commonwealth versus Willie Sanders. Can you explain that case for folks briefly?
Okay.
Because it's not only, I think, a legal case that's interesting, but it's also interesting about personally what happened to you in that whole story of that case.
Oh, I didn't know you knew about that. Well, I was not the lead attorney, first of all, but it happened in the 70s. At a time when Boston was still dealing with a lot of racial tension. Willie Sanders was a black man with no criminal record, very large family, who was charged with raping 8 different women in the Brighton neighborhood of Boston. What happened to me on a personal level was the judge in that case refused to recognize that I was a part of the defense team. When he wanted to have a conference with the lawyers on the case, he told his clerk to tell me that I couldn't come in.
Because you were a black woman?
Yes. Hmm. Tell that girl she can't come in. And so I was a brand new lawyer then, and I was a lot less restrained, let me say, than I came to be later on in my career, and we took care of that. And it worked out for the defendant in the case because we got a new judge who was committed to choosing a fair jury for the case, and Willie Sanders was acquitted.
And then you took the judge's seat.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. The supreme irony of that. Things have a way of working out.
So what would you say when you look back on all of the cases and the opinions from the court? What are the ones that you feel strongest about?
I think it's a very collegial court. And for the 3 years that I was there, there was never a large disagreement about any decision that the court made. But I can think of a couple that I'm really proud to have been associated with, and not being immodest here, but one that I contributed to writing. The decision about where convicted sex offenders, registered sex offenders, can live. I think it takes a lot to understand why the law should protect a person's right to be, no matter what crime they've committed. Mm. And in that situation, we had citizen towns all over the Commonwealth passing ordinances or developing regulations that people who are registered sex offenders can't live within certain places in their towns. And when you have a whole lot of towns doing that, that means that people aren't able to live anywhere. And that's a very difficult thing to explain to lay people who are understandably concerned about who lives next to them. But, you know, I'm really proud that our court understood the liberty interests, right, protecting people. They've got to live somewhere. So
what do you hope your legacy will be?
Well, I hope it's that I was somebody who committed to justice, equal justice, committed to fairness, and always on the lookout for a way to make that happen within the bounds of the law.
Is it sort of bittersweet to leave?
Mostly sweet. Only a little bit bitter. Bitter because all along the way I've made some wonderful friends. I've had a chance to do a lot of the work that I wanted to do. But sweet in a sense that there's so much going on in the country right now that I feel I should be involved in. And I obviously can't do that as a judge. In many respects, it feels just like the country that existed in 1971 when I came to Boston as a new lawyer. Jim Crow had only recently been vanquished, and now it's almost 50 years later, and some of those same issues that got me into the law are begging for attention today.
Yeah.
And I'm free to get involved.
Right, right. So what might that look like for you, Dina?
Well,
you're going to give us some news here?
No. The real pressing issue, I think, is what is happening with voting rights.
But when you look at it and you say voting rights was an issue 50 years ago that people were fighting, and they're still fighting. And when you look at the criticism of the criminal justice system and all of the coverage of police shootings and mass incarceration, I wonder how you don't get discouraged.
Well, you do. Hmm. Of course you're discouraged that after 50 years you're fighting a battle that you thought you had won. But that's the nature of racism. That's the nature of oppression. It's not ever really defeated, I think. And I think the people who are committed to working and fighting this issue understand that they're going to take one step forward and two steps backwards sometimes. But yes, you are discouraged, but that's the nature of the beast.
Well, Justice Geraldine Hines retired from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Friday. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the father of the medical thriller, novelist Robin Cook. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The writer often credited with popularizing the literary genre of medical thriller is Robin Cook. You may know his novels Coma or Outbreak, but the physician and author has just released his 35th book. Although the book, Charlatans, is a novel, it delves into medicine in the age of social media, as well as the controversial practice of concurrent surgeries, and it seems loosely based on some real events and hospitals here in Boston. Robin Cook joins us from WCAI in Woods Hole. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So this is, as we said, your 35th book. What is it about medical thrillers for you?
Well, I never expected to be a writer at all.
No?
And
It just seems that I fell into it because we have such an egregious healthcare system.
Hmm.
It was something that I sensed right when I got into medical school, within the first months. And because in a certain sense, I had watched all the medical shows. It was part of the reason that I went into medicine, because I wanted to be a Dr. Ben Casey or a Dr. Marcus Welby, MD, or something of that sort. But I realized the system was completely different, and that the public, including myself, didn't have any idea. And I thought that there was an opening for somebody to write about medicine in this country the way it really is. And, of course, when you're a medical student, there's no time, and then you graduate and you go from the frying pan into the fire, and there's no time when you're a resident. And but then I got drafted in the military, and I suddenly had some free time, so I started writing these fictional books about medicine so the general public can have some sort of an idea of what it's really like.
Hmm. But they're novels. Why not go the nonfiction route, or do you think you want to use the novel as almost an advocacy tool?
Absolutely. And in fact, if I look back in history, it seems that fiction is more powerful in terms of affecting public policy than nonfiction, which seems to be somehow amazing, because fiction is fictitious. And yet it has the power to influence people in a way that nonfiction doesn't, and also can go out to a lot more people. So a lot more people get awakened to an issue that they might not have gotten awakened by any other means. Often when you write a nonfiction book about the problems in medicine, the people who read it are those people who are already aware of the problem, so to speak. Whereas if you do it as a fiction book, like Charlatans, and you get it out to a lot of just normal people, and also to get a movie out. I think that we live in a culture that's very oriented towards the video, and I'm happy to say that that Charlatans is already going to be a motion picture as well. So
Wow. We'll
get the readers and the viewers, and they'll be able to see some things about medicine that they didn't think about before.
Hmm.
And one of them, as you mentioned in the introduction, is this issue about concurrent surgery.
Mm-hmm.
People have heard about it to some degree. There's been some excellent articles in the Boston Globe about it. But, you know, that's nonfiction. But the trouble with that kind of nonfiction is that as great as those articles were, the next day there's another something or other. Trump might say something or tweet something. Mm. And all of a sudden it goes out of people's minds in a way. And so it doesn't really have the potential effect of something that, if you read a novel and you identify with the characters in some form or fashion, it stays with you. Hmm. And so that's why I decided that fiction could be more powerful than nonfiction.
And so you would say then that you very much write your novels to become movies.
I have to say that my second novel, I definitely did. I wrote it as a screenplay first. That was Coma, and it did become a movie. And the whole reason I did that is I saw that if I was trying to influence public opinion, I had to get people to read my book. And my first book wasn't read by very many people. And so I had to do something to try to get the second book so that people could look at medicine from a slightly different point of view. And so I did write it as a movie first. Huh. And but then I got very much interested in just writing the books. And and also I realized that the movie industry was a different beast. And in fact, I was very strongly encouraged to move to Los Angeles. And since I didn't really think that that was something that I wanted to do, I decided I'd concentrate on writing the books.
Why in this particular book? Why the title, charlatans. And what is the issue in this book? That you mentioned concurrent surgeries, but there are a couple of issues going on simultaneously in this book. What do you think are the main issues that you hope to bring to light in this book, to bring the public's attention to?
Well, mainly the fact that our culture is changing so dramatically and so rapidly. And it seems that a lot of people aren't really all that aware of it. That's our general culture is changing. So is the culture of medicine changing for some of the same reasons and because of the internet and social media. So I wanted to bring this issue to the fore. And one aspect of it is that in a certain sense, we're all becoming charlatans because of this urge that social media, the pressure that social media is putting on people. I'd have to say it's somewhat of a narcissistic pressure. And also the fact that that might just be in terms of social situations, but in terms of business, it turns out that getting likes can be very, very beneficial. Hmm. There are some doctors now.
Right?
Yeah, there's some doctors now who their bonuses are dependent upon getting good feedback and appropriate likes on social media. And doctors are members of our society. And the other issue that I find interesting is that that even Facebook feels that probably somewhere around 10% of their profiles are fake profiles, that they're not even real people. Not only are people perhaps making things up about themselves, but even making up totally fictitious characters and using them for whatever reasons. And if you say 10% of Facebook users, we're talking about 100 million fake profiles out there. Hmm. And these dating sites also. Our whole culture is going in this direction, and it's having effect on medicine. Hmm. And doctors are using social media for various and sundry reasons. And one of the big...
Both good and bad, you would say.
Absolutely.
Though, right? I mean, they're
absolutely.
Not all bad. As
no.
much as there can be certainly some negative consequences, there are also, obviously, technology can do some very useful things in every field, including medicine, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I think most doctors don't realize that their patients are getting most of their information not from the medical profession now, but actually from social media and the internet. And this is going to change medicine, or it is already changing medicine, right. Because a lot of times patients now will come in to see the doctor and know quite a bit about some specific ailment or that they think they have or might have. And it's changing the interaction that goes on between the doctor and the patient. Frequently, the doctor feels he's got to kind of excuse himself and go quickly Google something and then come back and act as if they already knew what it was that the patient was asking.
When did you last practice medicine?
Well, I kind of think that I have never stopped. I don't have a private practice anymore, but once you're a doctor, you're always a doctor. And somehow I feel that I'm constantly acting as a doctor in some form or fashion. In fact, I think of myself, I'm more confident of myself as a doctor than I am as a writer.
But you don't actually practice medicine, per se, or see patients.
Yes, I don't have a private practice any longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I stay current. I get the New England Journal of Medicine, for instance, every week and probably read it more religiously now than I did when I was actually practicing medicine.
I guess I just wonder if you didn't feel this way, and we only have a minute left here, and I'm sorry about that, but if you didn't feel this way about the system, if the system were different, would you not write about it?
I might have run out of things to write. I might be the only person in the entire country that's benefiting from our screwy system. I mean, every day I pick up the newspaper and I say, I could write a book about that.
Right, right. And you have. Robin Cook is the author of 35 books, including Coma, Acceptable Risk, and Cure. His latest book is Charlatans. Robin Cook, thanks so much. It was delightful talking with you today.
My pleasure.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.